Blog Talk Radio.
Silo Wealth Advisory is the Mindful Money Company. Our investments screen over 5,000 companies across the globe for their environmental impact. We think it's important to consider how your investments can benefit you and society without sacrificing returns. Visit us at silowealthadvisory.com and check out our free 60-second retirement solution. For all your investment questions, call Jeff Bogart at 855-757-7452 or email Jeff at jeff@silowealthadvisory.com. Now, here's Jeff with the Mindful Revolution.
Namaste, everybody. I'm Jeff Bogart of Silo Wealth Advisory, the Mindful Money Company, and I'd like to welcome you to the Mindful Revolution, where we interview some of the world's foremost thinkers in mindfulness. If you get a chance, check out some of our fun blogs on the Silo website. A few upcoming ones are going to be The Grateful Dead is My Out-of-Town Girlfriend, and Death Takes a Holiday, or How I Have to Continue Paying for My Dead Dog to Banfield Pet Hospital. We'd love to hear from you during the show, so give us a call. Number 646-478-4157. Again, 646-478-4157 to talk to us live. You can email me, Jeff at Sila. That's S-I-L-A, wealthadvisory.com. If you're my Facebook buddy, you can ask me a question there as well. Real quick, I just want to remind everybody that all our shows are archived on Blog Talk Radio. So you've never missed a show. Don't worry about it. Just download it, your iPad, your iPod, your computer, and listen to whoever you like. So I'd just like to say, don't you dare miss our conversation today. It's with the illegitimate son of Harpo Marx and Mother Teresa. That is Wavy Gravy, who was at 79 years young, is more active and more effective in the world than he was decades ago. Back then, when he's still known as Hugh Romney, he stood on the stage at the original Woodstock concert and announced, "What we have in mind is breakfast in bed for $400,000." Wavy was a member of an entertainment activist commune known as the Hog Farm. Wavy was also the official clown of the Grateful Dead, and Mr. Gravy has expanded his activities over the past 2.5 decades to include co-directorship of Camp Winter Rainbow, a performing arts program for children, and the organizer of all-star rock concerts to raise money for a variety of causes. Most notably, SAVA, a foundation he co-founded in 1978, initially to combat preventable and curable blindness in the third world. And on May 17th, Mr. Gravy will host a concert benefiting SAVA to celebrate his 79th birthday. Wavy is also the subject of a fascinating documentary called Saint Misbehaving. So I'd like to say namaste, Wavy. How are you today? Hello, Wavy. Can you hear me, Wavy? Well, we're having some technical difficulties talking to Mr. Gravy here. So what I'm going to do is try calling him back. Can you hear me, Wavy? We have you online. Let's see if we got you there. Hello, Wavy.
Hello?
You there? Oh, here
yeah,
we are. All right. I didn't push the right button. Blame me. I'm the engineer, bottle washer, and cook here. My bad. How are you today, Wavy?
I am semi-spectacular. You have some
right.
Gravy in your ear. Perhaps a Q-tip. Wavy Gravy, hippie icon, flower geezer, and temple of accumulated error.
I love it. Hey, before we get to the current Wavy Gravy, tell us a little bit about your past. Like, where did you grow up? I know you're a comedian in your previous life. Tell us a little about your beginnings when you were Hugh Romney.
My checkered past? Maybe Chinese checkers. Let's see, how did it go? I was conceived in East Greenbush, New York, and quickly segued to Princeton, New Jersey, where my mom would put me in the yard for my morning airing. I was I suspect, 4 or 5 years old, when Albert Einstein came by. We were living in Princeton, you see, and the college was just a block away, and he said,
right.
What a cute little boy, can I take him for a walk around the block? And my mom's jaw hit the concrete. Her flabber was gasped, and she said, yeah. So I got to go around the block with Albert Einstein. And
wow.
I'm telling you that over the years of my life, not a year goes by that somebody is not grilling me about our conversation. Come on, I was 5 years old. I remember a shock of white hair predating Don King by half a century. He had a twinkle in his eye. He had sneakers. And he had a most peculiar odor. You remember smells from your childhood. And someday I'll walk up to somebody and say, hey, man, you smell like Albert Einstein.
I love it. I love it. Did your parents teach at the university?
No, my dad was an architect and traveled around a lot. And at one point, I was spirited away from my bed and taken into the hills because Martians had landed nearby. And we did not want to be radiated by Martians. This, of course, was the Orson Welles broadcast of War of the Worlds, and we just happened to be right near where they landed. And everybody was getting in their cars and hightailing it for the hinterland.
Wow, that is hilarious. How old were you then?
I was probably six. It was a year after Al. And then,
love it.
Let's see, we moved to Albany, New York. I was there for a while. Then to West Hartford, Connecticut, where I graduated from high school. And my parents had divorced and remarried and had kids, so I was kind of the odd thing out. So in order to get to go to college, actually, my high school advisor said, look, they're going to cut off the Korean GI Bill. Now, this war had been over for over a year, and it was my opportunity to get the Korean GI Bill. So I volunteered for the draft. I did 22 months in the service, mostly painting murals in mess halls and a little bit
of... Where were you stationed? I never knew this. Wow.
See, Fort Dix, New Jersey.
Uh-huh.
And then I got in trouble with a special service guy. I was putting together very interesting reviews. I actually had a guy who played Nola on his head with mallets. You closed your eyes, you swear it was Bill Jackson, man. And anyhow, the guy tried to grab me on the wiener, and I punched him. So I ended up in code school with the Armored Infantry Battalion. I'm supposed to parachute behind enemy lines and set up a Morse code station. And I got to go to Wiesbaden, Mainz, Gunzenheim in Germany, where I worked at a NCS, taking turns... keeping the planet safe from aggression through Morse code. I could say, suck you. I'm sorry, it slipped out.
It's internet radio. You can say fuck as much as you want, wavy.
That was very nice.
Internet radio. You can say as many F-bombs as you want. It's totally okay.
Oh, well, here it is in Morse code. That's it.
I love it. I had no idea you're in the Army. And then you became a comedian, right?
Hey, let me tell you one thing.
Sure.
I was painting mess halls and stuff and combat infantryman's badge over the steam table, and I could get two volunteers to hand me paint. So everybody wanted to be my assistant so they didn't have to go out and crawl around in the mud. So the entire company sucked up to me, and I would pick two people every day. And I cleaned my brushes on my uniform until I had a set of fatigues that was every color but khaki. And I'm walking across the four dicks, and this general pulls up and says, "What army are you in, soldier?" "Yes, sir." And I ended up doing a portrait of his niece.
Never the conformist, were you? We have to blame it on Albert Einstein, right?
Then I came back from overseas and went to Boston University. They had an amazing theater school. I started jazz and poetry on the East Coast in Boston. I'd read about it in Time magazine that they were doing jazz and poetry in San Francisco. So I said, "Hey, I know some musicians. Hey, I can write a poem." And so we opened in Boston on Huntington Avenue in the basement of a bar called The Rock. And the basement was called The Pebble in the Rock. And I got the kids from the museum school to decorate with black tablecloths and mobiles. And it was just so wonderful. And then my co-poet and I went to Kennebunkport and opened a coffee house in Kennebunkport across from Weinstein's grocery store. We had stumbled down the beach, stopping briefly at Snowberry's and Ken's.
Oy vey, there were Jews in Kennebunkport? Oy vey!
Yeah. This was a very long time ago, and I brought Kunga drummers from the Greenwich Village to Kennebunkport, and we rocked their world. And they can't be selling just coffee in there. 50 cents a cup, they're selling dope to the teenagers. Actually, we were buying dope to the teenagers. They had the best
well,
dope.
You know what? They had to make a living. We all had to make a living, right?
And then
so did you end up in the village doing comedy?
No. This came much later. I was a beat poet. I was a teenage beatnik. And what happened was that the main university in Boston thought that we were not doing enough social studies, and so they were going to take the campus that we had. Beautiful gargoyles and brick buildings with ivy, and move it from St. Batal Street all the way over to the main campus. So all these amazing teachers, I studied dance with Martha Graham, by the way, and all
wow.
these amazing teachers mostly were hired during the McCarthy blackball, so they could not work on Broadway. So that's why the theater school was so amazing.
Got it.
Once the university messed with them, the black ball was over, they all quit and went and taught at the Neighborhood Playhouse in New York and took me with them on a full scholarship. And so I began to read my poetry in the coffee houses of Greenwich Village, ending up in the Gaslight, which was prime real estate for poetry reading, and later prime real estate for folk music. In fact, it was my idea to have some folk music in with the poetry. And the place was run by a lunatic named John Mitchell. "Mr. Romney, I made all my money with poetry." I said, "Come on, John, let's try it." And we tried it, and it was wonderful. And we would pass a basket around, and people would put money in the basket. And we would divide up the money, and we made an amazing amount of money for, you know, practicing our art. It was quite phenomenal. Len Chandler, who did the FTA thing with Jane Fonda, he had the motor scooter, and his wife made us capes with hoods. He was an African American, and we would drive into the Bowery and find people passed out on the sidewalk and creep up and put money in their pockets and drive off. It was great fun.
I love it.
Occasionally, somebody would come too while we were doing it, and there we were with our hoods and money. And I'm sure that there was a buzz that went through the homeless community about these strange beings, probably from another planet. Len Chandler was quite wonderful, by the way. That song, Green, Green, Rocky Road, which was in the Coen Brothers film,
right,
was Len and Bob Kaufman, the poet from Martinique.
Actually, you were being very yogic about your money.
Yeah.
You guys are practicing yoga with your money. I don't know if you knew that, but you were. Yeah.
We didn't know that, but we had more than we needed. And
that's what it's about,
A fun thing to do. It was always about I had this room up over the Gaslight, and I remember when Bob Dylan came into the Gaslight, he was wearing Woody Guthrie's underwear.
Oh, my gosh.
And he had a sign on his guitar that said, "This machine kills fascists." And he says, "Can I go on, man? Can I go on?" And it was a hootenanny. And
right,
I just grabbed the mic. I said, "Here he is, a legend in his lifetime. What's your name, kid?"
Was he Bill Zimmerman or Dylan at that time?
We ended up sharing that room upstairs. And Hard Rain's Gonna Fall was actually written on my typewriter.
Oh, my Lord. Woo. Living history here with Wavy Gravy on Blog Talk Radio. Yeah.
Springsteen. Bruce Springsteen says, "You still got that typewriter?" It was actually eaten by a Beacon's storage unit. They had a fire. And it also, all my stuff. I had a couch that belonged to Lenny Bruce, a beautiful purple velvet couch that went up with the original draft of Hard Rain's Gonna Fall. But
wow. As
I say, stuff comes, stuff goes. This is the way of stuff.
It's stuff. I agree. You know, my yoga teacher said, Wavy, she said, when you're being in the limousine in your coffin going to your grave site, there's not going to be a U-Haul of your stuff dragging it behind to be buried with you. The Pharaohs tried it. It didn't work. It's just stuff. Now, speaking of Lenny Bruce, was he a contemporary of yours?
Well, here's the deal. I began to be overwhelmed with the task of trying to write more and more poetry, and it got more and more difficult as I got better at it, and it didn't just spew out of me so much as I had to work at it. And so I also began to talk about the weird stuff that would happen to me during that day or the day before. This guy came in and put me in a suit and started mailing me around the country saying, "Skip the poetry, just talk about the weird stuff." And next thing you know, I'm opening for John Coltrane, Thelonious Monk. I did Peter,
wow,
Paul and Mary's first gig at the Bitter End. We opened the Bitter End. It was not the Bitter End before we opened it. It was called the Cock and Bull on Bleecker Street.
Mm-hmm. Now,
and,
let me ask you this. Was it evident to you that Coltrane was Coltrane back then? Or Peter, you know what I'm saying? They were. He maybe not been nationally recognized.
Oh, my God. Both him and Monk. And I also opened for Monk in Hollywood at the Renaissance. And it was a wonderful, wonderful club run by Benny Shapiro, who was the main innovator of contemporary entertainment. In not only in L.A., but he sent people all over the place. But the Renaissance, there was this big, long stairway going down to the dressing room. And I took some chalk, and I wrote on the steps, go back two. Turn around three times, go forward five. And all the way down the stairs, I wrote little things. And then I hid and waited for Monk to show up. And he comes in, and he looks at the stairs. And sure enough, he spins around three times, goes forward two, back four. And it took him about 15 minutes to make it down the stairs. It was hilarious. And then
I could see Monk doing that and dancing. I could see him dancing to that. I don't know why, but I can just picture him dancing like that.
He was dancing. He was dancing as he did it. And then I coaxed him into the closet, and we smoked a joint. A big, fat doobie of the most amazing weed that would put you in free fall. There was no earth to step on. You were kind of floating. And I was good for maybe four tokes, and it took me over a day to come down. Monk, just one toke, and you just saw this coal get larger and larger and larger. And I thought, oh, my God, how's he going to play the piano? And he goes up and he sits at the piano, and he goes, where? And he hits the wood on both sides with his knuckles. Then he made an adjustment and played flawlessly for the rest of the night. It was, incredible.
The younger people listening, who weren't around back then, and I wasn't quite either, but I know comedians used to open up for jazz players, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and get thee to a record store or somewhere. You must investigate the music of John Coltrane and Thelonious Monk.
God,
it will change your life.
It changed mine.
They
I agree.
To this day, great geniuses and wonders to behold with your eyes, ears, nose, and throat, man.
Hey, but we have a phone call. You want to take a phone call? This is Fadia.
Absolutely.
Fadia with an app. She's
a
yoga teacher in our Michigan. A real live yoga teacher. She's our favorite. She actually does some guest hosts in the shows, too. Hey, Fadia.
Hey, Jeff. Hi, Wavy Gravy. How are you?
Semi-spectacular.
I say you're full-out spectacular, but, we can all, see it our way. You are a fascinating person. I just heard your name for the first time ever on Jon Stewart for the 420 show, and he was dressed up as Wavy Gravy. Yeah, he's dressed up as Wavy Gravy, and he's like, and one of his, other extras on the show, she's like, oh, stop, Wavy Gravy, even though nobody knows what that is. And it's kind of funny because I was like, I know who that is. He's going to be on the show. I know who he is. So I felt special. But so I definitely got it. But you know, what I find most fascinating about your story is the Albert Einstein part, because I'm thinking, like, when you're that young, when you have somebody so magnificent and brilliant in your company, and it was really very random, I'm sure, that has to really set you up in life to just have a fantastic life, which you sound like you have had. But you know what's really interesting about Albert Einstein, who's one of my most favorite people that I've learned about, is that he was a pacifist. And despite his position as a pacifist, he still helped create one of those powerful weapons in the world. And to go on and say, don't use it, but then it still got used. And I'm sure you guys experienced all of that and, felt the deep sadness around what happened, if it was clear to you, with these crazy weapons. But how do you suppose that's even a possibility? And do you think we just live in a fear-based society? Do we all have to be more like you, jolly? Look, we need more happy people in the world. I mean, what's your take on that?
I think that if you don't have a sense of humor, it just isn't funny anymore. Laughter is the valve on the pressure cooker of life. Either you laugh at stuff or you're going to end up with your brains or your beans on the ceiling.
Oh, that's wonderful.
I love it.
Yeah. So, So I'm on the right track, man. We need more happy people in the world. You think that's probably a big must right now?
And when you do yoga, you stand on your head, and I maintain if you stand on your head long enough, gravity will get you smiling.
Good point.
Definitely.
Yeah, he's right. Yeah.
I know. I mean, I love standing.
We are doing a bunch of yoga benefits here in the Bay Area for Nepali earthquake relief. If you check your West Coast yoga sources, you'll see that to be the case. Plus my 79th birthday, we have Edward Sharp and the Magnetic Zeros and Steve Kimmock and Hot Buttered Rum. It's going to be an amazing show. And
where's that going to be held, Wavy? Where's that being held?
It's being held in Roanoke Park in this outdoor Sonoma venue that I've never performed at, but I understand it holds about 4,000 people, and we've sold half the tickets. And we are also going to silent auction 10 Tibetan tankas, really very skilled ancient art that is all going for the earthquake relief. We
What date is this?
We drove. May 17th. My birthday's May 15th.
Your birthday, okay.
We're
is that the city of Sonoma or the county of Sonoma?
Yeah.
Oh, I want to tell people: is that the city of Sonoma or the county of Sonoma?
No, it's I don't know. It's in Roanoke Park.
Somewhere.
Just go to seva.org, and
got
the
it.
Ad will pop right up.
Okay.
And that's
beautiful.
My 79th birthday. In 21 years, I'll be 100, and that'll be an amazing party, too. Methuselah said the first 100 years are the hardest, and I maintain it's all downhill after that. Yep.
I want to be at that
party.
Any
other questions for Wavy?
Yeah, Wavy. Do you think that the increase in – I ask this to everybody, and I want to hear your answer because you're cool. Do you think the increase in the yoga is going to help bring more peace into the world? Because it just seems like yoga is getting more and more and more popular. Do you think that's going to increase more peaceful people being willing to look outside themselves and help each other out?
Not only looking outside themselves, but looking inside themselves and being inside out is and sideways is how I enjoy it. And I also not only have given my life to SEVA, but an organization called Camp Win a Rainbow, which is a circus and performing arts camp where we actually teach some yoga to kids, along with juggling, tightrope, trapeze, unicycle, tall stilts. Our theater department goes from Shakespeare to improv. Our dance department from hip-hop to West African, every which way but up. And these kids give me nostalgia for the future.
Awesome. Thank you so much. It's really great getting to know you, and I'm going to check out Monk for sure because he sounds cool. But, you know, thank you for being on the show, and you guys enjoy the rest of your interview. Have a wonderful
evening. Thanks, Fadi. Hey,
Fadi,
you're going to have a guest show one pretty soon, right?
Yeah, on Saturday we're going to have, I have two guests, Larry Love and Soham Shah, and they're both marijuana activists, cannabis activists, and we'll be talking about marijuana in America and also in the world, and I'm pretty excited about that. Yep.
Cool. Is that coming Saturday?
That's this coming Saturday, yes.
Okay. So
I'm not
for
sure
people
the
want
time.
To listen a little bit about marijuana activism, listen to Fadia on this show, The Mindful Revolution. She'll do a guest host show, and that's we love her for it. Thanks,
yeah,
Fadia.
For sure.
Good
I loved it.
You.
Yeah, thanks.
Okay.
All right. Bye.
Bye now. It was Fadia.
She
calls every week.
Hysterical, amazing adventure. After Woodstock, Warner Brothers wanted to do some kind of sequel. And out of the fertile mind of Tom Donahue, who started Radical FM with KMPX and KSAN in the Bay Area,
right.
He had this idea driving across the country with a caravan of buses, which is something that we had been doing for 6 years or 7 years, and he was gonna. We would set up a contingent of tie-dye teepees, create a stage, and then Warner Brothers would fly in their stars to perform on these little stages that we would set up, and they would film it all. The filmmaker was a Frenchman named François Rauschenbach, and we were first calling the show Cruising for Burgers. It later became Medicine Ball Caravan. We were constantly being followed by the publisher of High Times magazine, Thomas King Facade, and he had this old hearse with a Viet Cong flag painted on the side and a four-poster bed on the roof. And he and David Peel of the Lower East Side would follow the caravan and torment us as we had Van Morrison and Joni Mitchell playing around a campfire. B.B. King did a show. There were great shows. Okay, this is the one I want to tell you about. Coming
sure.
into Ohio and Antioch University, Antioch
right.
College. Well, I'll tell you, the San Luis Obispo wanted to do this big music festival, and instead of Hell's Angels, they wanted me because I was the head of security at Woodstock. The password was I forgot. They wanted me to head up security for this festival. So I said, instead of Hell's Angels for security, what I want to use is a moat full of Jell-O. So I sent a communication to General Foods that I, Wavy Gravy, head of security at the Woodstock Music Festival, would like to use your product in this security situation, and they mailed me maybe 10 cases of Jell-O.
Oh, my
and
Lord.
And then the festival got called off because the town mothers freaked out and they didn't want hippies in their yard. And so we put the Jell-O in the possum belly of our 48 Greyhound. The possum belly is where, when it was taking passengers, where the luggage would go in the underneath
right.
of the bus. So we filled it up with Jell-O. Then when we arrived at Antioch College, Thomas King Facade had ditched his four-poster bed and replaced it with the turret to a B-29 Flying Fortress. And it looked like a giant plastic dessert dish. Screaming for Jell-O.
Oh,
so we set it up
so
on
funny.
Stage and filled it with Jell-O. As it was just beginning to be sunrise, the Jell-O solidified, cherry Jell-O. It was beautiful, about 4.5 feet deep. And so the sun got hotter, and then the Jell-O began to de-Jell-ify and turn into cherry soup. And I thought all was lost. Wait, hold it. What to do? Dry ice. We'd bought
yeah.
up all the dry ice in Yellow Springs, Ohio, and threw it in the dessert dish of magnitude, and the Jell-O de-Jell-ified, and not only did it de-Jell-O, it became geothermal. These gaseous bubbles would rise up from the bottom of the bowl and rise up and announce themselves as they hit the lip of the bloop, and so I'm miking the bloops, and the whole audience is going, bloop, bloop, bloop. And these hippies made this great banner, one of my favorite anti-war banners of all time. And it said, "World peace through smoking." Oh. Was it, as far as I'm concerned.
Oh my lord. And then so we got kind of like a USO program for hippies, kind of. It was almost.
We kept driving until we got to New York, and then we parked our buses and got into an Air India aircraft, paid for by Columbia Pictures, that flew us to England, where we ended up in Canterbury, doing a show with Pink Floyd outside.
I love it.
On the sward. And it was right around then in London that we saw this play about Gandhi, where Gandhi said, if God were to appear to starving people, God would not dare to appear in any other form than food.
Why not?
If people remember your Woodstock history, my famous line is, "Good morning. What we have in mind is breakfast in bed for 400,000. And that's when we introduced hippies to granola. They had never seen granola before.
Whoa.
And we brought it to them in Dixie cups. They were enmeshed in mud in their sleeping bags in the front of the stage, and we brought them granola. And they looked at it, they said, "What is this shit, gravel?" But no, it was granola. And they loved it and liked it. And as Wavy Gravy often says, you're not what you eat, you are what you don't shit. Gotcha. Gotcha.
Oh, gosh. Oh,
so,
Lord. Okay, let me try to take
control
back here.
There was this great hurricane that devastated Bangladesh back then.
We thought,
what if we went there and fed people? We had so much media from running the free kitchen at Woodstock. What if we showed up and brought food to the starving people? We couldn't feed the multitudes, but we could embarrass the governments to get off their ass and do a bet. My God, there's hippies doing it. We better do it better. So we filled up these English rock promoters had a benefit for us in the Roundhouse in London, where they were at that time showing O Calcutta. So there was lots of great lights, and we had Tyrannosaurus Rex and various English bands, and our band Stone Ground, and they bought us this Leland bus that used to drive around Scotland and had a destination sign, Stirling Hoe. So I said, put a G on the end of that. So it became the Stirling Hog, because we are the hog farm. And by the way, we are still the hog farm. This commune is still together close to 50 years now. And,
Let me go back a second. Well, I'm going to talk about the hog farm, but when did Hugh Romney become Wavy Gravy? Who was it, B.B. King, who called you Wavy Gravy? How did that name stick?
Yeah, this was right after Woodstock. We returned to our home base in Llano, New Mexico, and all these hippies had come from all over the country to live with us forever. It was a terrifying thought, but these big shiny buses showed up from Texas, and they wanted the hog farm to do security for their rock and roll show, because they were doing, there was a rodeo and rock and roll, and there was all this friction. And so they loaded us on their buses and drove us to Texas, to Lewisville, Texas, where we set up camp on Lake Dallas, this enormous lake. So there was no difficulty with water like there was at Woodstock. until it fell out of the sky. There was a great shortage of
I didn't know that.
Water. Anyhow, in Texas, we set up a free stage, and I am laying on the floor of the free stage, and this announcement came over the PA. B.B. King is here with his bus. He wants to play for free. Could we clear the stage? And I'm getting up really slow. It was before one of my multitudes of back surgeries, and I felt this hand on my shoulder. And I looked up, and there was B.B. King. And he looked down at me and said, "You Wavy Gravy?" I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "Well, Wavy Gravy, I can work around you." And he leaned me up against his amplifier, took out his guitar named Lucille, and from out of the other side of the stage came Johnny Winter, and they jammed until sunrise.
Wow.
And it was everybody's reward for putting on their pants and picking up the trash. They had to put their pants on. The Job's daughters could not handle the skinny dipping, and they were going to call the National Guard.
So the way the gravy stick down, was that the end of Hugh Romney? Was that kind of the transformation from you to Wavy?
At that time, I also taught improvisation at the Cal State University, Neurologically Handicapped Experimental School, and my classes were filmed and taped through one-way glass, and these professors came running in after the class. "Keep that name Wavy Gravy, you saved a week's orientation." Because when I said Wavy Gravy, they just wanted to play and have fun. Whereas Hugh Romney is kind of boring.
So yeah, it sounds like an old kind of WASPy, like a Bush kind of family almost, you know? Old Mayflower kind of thing,
exactly.
Hugh Romney.
And, you know, we were given a mountaintop rent-free if we would tend 50 hogs the size of large Davenports. And then when we made this film for Otto Preminger called Skidoo, Groucho Marx played God and all that stuff, and we had enough money to put some buses on the road and start doing this traveling show called The Hog Farm and Friends in Open Celebration. And we would be sponsored by the STS and the Interfraternity Council of all these colleges around the country, and they would pay for our expenses and our gas, and we would just go from college to college doing this. It was like the acid test, but we didn't supply the acid. You had to bring your own head. And we set up a pallet where we'd have 200 people working on a big painting together. We would have inflatable plastic things that we would project on in the evening. We set up teepees. We set up this giant geodesic dome that we put panels in to project on. And it was while we were doing this particular dance, actually we ended up in New York City, and we were at this woman's kitchen table that was about 60 feet long, and this guy came in looking like Allen Ginsberg on a Dick Gregory diet, and he said, "How would you guys like to do this music festival? How'd you like to do this music festival in New York State?" And they gave us the date, and we said, "Well, we're going to be doing the summer solstice on the Tizuki Indian Reservation outside of Santa Fe." And he said, "That's all right. We'll fly you in an Astrojet." So we figured he was one toke over the line, and, you know, and we didn't pay him any attention until he actually showed up on this Indian reservation for the summer solstice. And he had this styly aluminum briefcase where, indeed, there was an American Airlines Astrojet to take 85 of us and 15 Indians to Kennedy Airport, where we would be bused to White Lake, New York, and Max Yasgur's farm to do this aquarian exhibition called Woodstock.
Right.
Strange, but...
And you guys were the security at Woodstock, right?
Yeah, and I did stage announcements of life support because the guy who built the stage at Woodstock and was also the road manager for the Rolling Stone did lighting for Harry Belafonte towards his entire career was a guy named Chip Monk.
Right,
and Chip
Monk.
Knew
yeah, yeah, yeah.
That I could get on a microphone and I could say hospital and people would not break their legs. They would know a hospital is a safe place to go to get your situation treated with. And so I was allowed to make these stage announcements, which was a great
really?
Honor.
And also you guys
and
were not the police force, you were the police force, right?
Police force, yes. And Tom Law and I were the police chiefs, and he was the guy who taught yoga in the Woodstock movie, actually.
It worked, huh? Unlike what happened in San Francisco soon after, in Altamont, it worked. Obviously, everyone didn't. Hey, so let me ask you, 50 years ago, because I know you and I are both deadheads. I've seen you at Dead concerts. We didn't meet.
Oh, yeah.
I played cheerleaders once. Could you ever imagine the Grateful Dead being one of the most successful rock bands ever?
Well, I was at the formation of the Grateful Dead. I didn't make it to Mother McGree's Jug Band, but we did do those early acid tests with the Dead and the Pranksters that later cemented the band together. And I remember the Watts. Can I tell you about the Watts acid test?
Yeah.
With the Grateful Dead?
Yeah.
This was the biggest acid test. It was in L.A. on the eve of Lincoln's birthday. They had just finished having the Watts riots. So naturally, the Pranksters rented this huge warehouse in Watts. And everybody showed up for the acid test. And we had great sound. Owsley did a magnificent job of wiring the place for sound. And this was the day that LSD became illegal, that night. So I got
that
on
night,
the PA
okay.
and
you're
I said,
legal
okay,
to that night, right?
I said, everybody listen to me now. This is very important. We had these giant galvanized garbage cans full of Kool-Aid. The Kool-Aid on the right is for the kids. The Kool-Aid on the left is the electric Kool-Aid. Now let's review. The Kool-Aid on the right for the kids. And I went over this about 20 times, but people had been dancing for 3 hours to the Grateful Dead. They just wanted to hook up with something wet. And wet was a couple hundred micrograms hollow. And half the place started melting down. And the woman started to go crazy. And she's going, who cares? Who cares, Roy? LSD! And Ken Babs, Kesey's lieutenant, found her and stuck a microphone in her chops. And suddenly, into everybody's deep, is broadcast, who cares? Who cares? And I crawled to a microphone. I says, some sister is unglued. And I think it would be, let's glue her back together. So let's find her and make her feel better and stop screaming. And I'll meet you where she is. Who cares? Who cares? So I set out in search of her. It took me about, 15 or 20, who knows, time. But I found her. And she was surrounded by about 20 people, some of whom I recognized. We joined hands. We turned into jewels and light. She stopped screaming and turned into jewels and light, and that's when I passed the acid test. When you get to the very bottom of the human soul, where the knit
right.
is slamming into the grit and you're sinking, but you reach down to help somebody who is sinking worse than you are, that's when everybody gets high, and you don't even need LSD to do that.
No, you don't. I agree. I agree 100%. So back to my question, could you perceive back then the Grateful Dead having greatness like Coltrane? I don't think they were technically astute, and the energy was there. Could it be seen that these guys were going to, like, rock the world, literally?
They played Coltrane jammed with the Grateful Dead.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that. Wow.
Many, several great jazz musicians throughout the, you know.
Yeah, I knew
their,
that. I didn't know Coltrane.
Their,
right.
Their, and, you know, toward their, when they were at their peak form, often they would combine great jazz musicians with the band. Roland Kirk, also one of the
Ron
great.
Ron, oh my Lord, woo, didn't know that either.
I was born ten years too late.
What can I tell you? Yeah,
he could play several saxophones at once.
Oh yeah, he was incredible.
I got to be friends with him at Ken Kesey's place. When Kesey
right.
passed away, I looked out the window. I didn't know what had happened, but I saw all these TV trucks, and I kind of felt that somebody in my cultural sphere has dropped their body, and I'm supposed to talk about it. So they came up with their cameras and mics, and I said, well, Ken gave me my family values. And they weren't ready for that. He said to me, always try and put your good where it'll do the most. And that phrase has echoed through my heart and soul from the moment he said it to me to this very moment that I am saying to you.
Try and put
your good will do the most.
Right. I love that spirit. I love that spirit. So you're talking about riots and stuff, and I read somewhere.
Oh, I wrote a haiku. Let me jump in. I wrote a haiku for Ken when he passed away.
Oh, let's hear it.
I often do this when people pass. This one goes like so. They say Kesey's dead, but never trust a prankster, even underground. That's a haiku. It's called such as is 575. The one I wrote for Garcia when he passed, let's see. The fat man rocks out. Hinges fall off heaven's door. Come on in, says Bill. Now, Bill in this haku is Bill Graham, who passed away.
Ain't
just,
that the truth? Ain't that the truth, buddy? Woo! Yeah, I love it. Yeah. These people were so revolutionary, so talented. Just, it must have been amazing to be at the vanguard of it all. Speaking of the vanguard of it all, you realized, I guess, I saw this in the movie Saint Misbehaving, which we'll talk about, but you said that you started dressing up like a clown or Santa Claus because the riot cops don't beat Santa Claus.
No. Here's how it happened. I was approached by doctors from the Oakland Children's Hospital.
Oh, okay.
They had read something about me being some kind of hippie social worker, that would I consider going to the children's hospital and entertaining some children. And I thought, well, okay, anything. I was having a lot of pain. I've had, you know, many back surgeries, and anything to distract me and get me away from my own pain seemed like a
sure.
good idea. And on my way out the door to go to the hospital, which was maybe 20 blocks away, somebody handed me a red rubber nose.
Hmm.
And so I put that nose on, and it made it easy. And I thought, darn. And slowly, I began to develop the patina of a clown. This clown from Ringling Brothers gave me his giant shoes because he was retiring, and he wanted his feet to go on walking. Beautiful, giant, wingtip clown shoes. And somebody else had a clown suit made up for me. And I began to do makeup. And, you know, that maybe 20% of all children are terrified of clowns. So I began to put my makeup on with the children in front of the youngest kids.
Oh,
so
I see.
Kind of demonstrified the clown. And then, of course, one day I had to go to the People's Park to a political demonstration, and I did not have time to remove the makeup, so I just went there.
People's Park in Berkeley,
that's
California,
when I discovered,
correct? Okay.
That's when I discovered that clowns were safe.
Got it. The policemen don't hit a clown.
Yeah, so I got to buy out every red rubber nose in Kansas and Missouri at the Republican convention. I forget what year it was. But we circumnavigated the Kempner Arena in Kansas City with clowns. And this guy, John Bryant, had to go far away, and he had a press pass for his Open City newspaper, and he gave me his laminated press pass. So I immediately sipped away and put on a three-piece suit, usually reserved for Halloween. And I went in with the press pass and went to the World Press booth and started writing up press passes for nobody, because that's who we were running for president. Because nobody's perfect and nobody keeps all campaign promises, and nobody should have that much power, and nobody bakes apple pie better than mom. And we'd have these great rock and roll shows, and then nobody would speak. And for the speeches, we used these wind-up clicking plastic teeth. So I go in to the World Press booth at the Republican convention, and I'm typing up press releases for nobody and handing them out to the World Press, when I am spotted by this Kansas City cop who gets on his walkie-talkie and calls the FBI and the Secret Service, who immediately throw me into a Lenny Bruce curtain call, started patting me down, and this cop feels this bulge in my pocket. He says, "Is that a gun?" And he whips out the plastic teeth, start clicking in his hand. I says, "Quiet, our leader is speaking." He rolls his eyes. He gives me back the teeth and says, "Get out of here. You're too weird to arrest." I try to keep it that way.
Yeah, definitely.
What a thrill.
Definitely. So there were a lot of riots back then. I want to bring up something, because now we're having some riots in Baltimore. And I just read this bizarre quote today by a Republican, U.S. House Representative Bill Flores, who argued that the violence in Baltimore could be linked to legalization of same-sex marriage in the United States. How can someone think like, what do they think? What is this guy thinking?
That's
how do you combat idiocy like that?
There's a lot of wackadoodles out there, boss, and what we just got to do is identify them as wackadoodles and say, okay, and move on to something that's a little more intelligent than that. I think that the abject poverty and unemployment and stuff like that had a bit to do with it. In fact, more than
yeah,
a
wee bit, right.
When
I read this stuff, I just want to, you know, the rest of my hair turns gray. What can I tell you? What can I tell you? Hey, you want to go over a little bit? We got to, you know, the show theoretically ends. We can go over. It's internet radio. You got time?
I can do a little bit.
Okay.
Sure.
So we're going to go over.
Sure.
We may not record, but so what? We're having a great time here with Wavy Gravy on the Mindful Revolution Blog Talk Radio. Just loving the conversation. Wavy's going to turn 79, and he's going to have a great concert real soon for his 79th birthday. Did you ever think you'd make it this far, 79 years old?
I didn't think I'd break 30.
Okay.
I was living very intensely. I lived in, in a school bus. Started out, the Roadhog was an actual school bus, and I had, you know, multitudes of back surgeries, and they could get me out of the window of the bus in a stretcher into a demonstration in about 25 minutes. We headed down to a drill to get me. The first body cast, in fact, they used to carry me on stage at Grateful Dead shows and put me under the piano in my stretcher.
Oh, no.
And we painted the cast blue, and it went from my nipples to my knees with a bar between my knees, and then we put stars, white stars all over this dark blue cast, and I maintained that was my all-star cast. Now, even better than that was the last cast. And, you know, they used to keep me in plaster for 4 months after surgery. Now they get you up the next day and get you walking.
Right. Why were you in a body cast? What happened that you were in a body cast?
I got beat up a lot by the police and the National Guard. I was fragile to begin with. Stuff happened. But the last cast, we covered with money from all over the world, and that was the cast of thousands. And I stuck my stomach way out so I could always keep a couple ounces of clean reefer inside, and the only way you could get to it is if I sucked in my stomach, you could reach in and grab it. So I was Stash. I was the human Stash. And like I say, the only way the police could get to it, they'd have to saw me in two. It was hilarious. And
all
I
right.
had plenty of
yeah.
plenty of company, let me tell you.
Let's talk about a little bit about the documentary about yourself, Saint Misbehaving. What was it like to be the subject of a movie? Was it kind of like writing a biography of sorts? Tell me how'd that feel? How did you like the process of it all?
The thing is that we started our adventure on this mountaintop with 50 hogs, and this whole and getting buses together and starting to tour with the pig and the show was all documented by a guy named David Lebrun for his graduate thesis at University of California Film School, which is where Spielberg and those guys all went.
Right, right.
So we were kind of used to being filmed, and we were certainly filmed at Woodstock.
Sure.
I remember when we got off the plane at Woodstock, 85 of us and 15 Indians, we had arranged with the promoters that we could do a free kitchen. And we didn't have any idea of this other involvement. But when we came off the plane, this guy, and there's countless movie cameras and blazing lights and just this whole media frenzy, the hog farm, you know, you guys are doing the security. And I said to the reporter, well, do you feel secure? He says, yeah. I said, well, see, it's working. he got really pissed off. He said, come on, what are you going to use for crowd control? And I said, cream pies and seltzer bottles. And they all wrote it down. The power of manipulating the media. And this was all filmed and also included in this amazing movie that Michelle Ezrich put together. She worked on it for 10 years. When we drove two buses from London to the Himalayas, we had gone to the director of the Medicine Ball Caravan, the French director, who Warner Brothers took the film away from him and edited it themselves and made it into a piece of shit because they were upset at him for not being fast enough and having it ready fast enough. So anyhow, Michelle, we got the rough film from Francois Rauschenbach to take with us in our journey to the East. And he also gave us an Aeroflex movie camera. So because we just had just a small amount of film, the people that were doing the filming would squeeze off little bursts. And she was able to go into our storage locker where we had kept this film for 20 years, paying storage film rates, and edit it into this film that she actually worked on this film for 10 years. She got archival footage from all over the world, and she also did filming at our house with me all over the place. It played in theaters all over the country. Then it was on Showtime.
Right.
It was on PBS. It was shown all over Canada. And now you can get it actually through Seva.org. That's the best way to get it. You can also do Netflix. But it's better if you get it through Seva or through StBehaven.com, you get DVD extras. In other words, there's a whole other hour of footage that does not appear in the Netflix version. And it's so worth it because I was very disturbed that many things didn't make it into the movie. And Michelle said, relax, DVD extras. And
she was
right.
Yeah, she was right. Cool. Let's do a little word association with a few people. You can do a haiku, whatever you want. Going to name a few people back in your life. One, Lenny Bruce.
Lenny Bruce was my manager at one point, which was astounding. It lasted for about 2 hours, and he got in trouble. And I ended up getting typists to type up his legal briefs. Wherever I'd go, I'd say, "Can you type? You want to meet Lenny Bruce?" And I would take him up to Lenny's place. He lived at 8825 Hollywood Boulevard. I was kind of responsible for him breaking his leg. I left a contingency of psychotropics on his bureau at the Swiss American Hotel in San Francisco with a note on the DMT that said, "Smoke till the jewels fall out of your eyes." Well, Lenny had never seen, color. He always saw things in blacks and whites and grays.
Was he colorblind?
So he was something blind, whatever that is. He was really colorblind. But suddenly, he saw vivid color for the first time in his life.
Whoa.
And he was hopping all over the hotel room. He was there with Eric Miller, and he just jumped on the window ledge and accidentally went out through the window. And in midair, he screamed up to Eric Miller, "Man shall rise above the rule," and then thud. He hit the street. It was two stories.
Hard cold reality, huh? Woo.
So I zoomed to the hospital. I said he was my uncle, and I wanted to seal up his room because they were, the press was making hay with all his disposable syringes and what have you. And they had, Lenny was on a gurney. He was getting ready to have his leg set, so he was in no pain. And he said to me, it was worth it. And he totally, you know, I was feeling so guilty about this, and he totally cut me loose. And then I got him to write a note on the, we had a paper bag. He wrote on the side of the paper bag, this man can seal a room. So I got to do that.
Ah, what about, let's talk about someone who's not, let's talk about someone, Joni Mitchell. I know she's having some health problems now. A few thoughts on Joni.
I've only Joni Mitchell, what a great artist. You know, you're going to hear more about Joni from, say, David Crosby, Graham Nash, friends of mine, but and we're really close to Joni. I only had one full evening with Joni at a club in the balcony, and I had a yo-yo, and I taught Joni how to yo-yo in the course of the evening, and
I love it.
Send the yo-yo off the balcony, and go almost. We got this long string on the yo-yo, so it would go way down there and then way up, and it was big fun. And well, she's a great genius. What can I say? Her poetry is phenomenal. And her sense of jazz and her awareness of the great people like Furry Lewis. That's how I met my wife. She had this restaurant on Sunset Boulevard called the Fred C. Dobbs. You remember Fred C. Dobbs?
No, I don't.
Yes, you do. Humphrey Bogart played him in The Treasure of Sierra Madre.
Oh, yes.
Nobody ever put anything over on Fred C. Dobbs. So, she had this beautiful restaurant. Like I said, she had Furry Lewis on the jukebox. She served these enormous mugs of Kool-Aid. Marlon Brando used to hang out there, and the Birds, and she put peanuts in my hamburger, and I fell in love. That was it.
I love it.
She was in Star Trek. She was
your wife was
Star
wow.
Trek. Yeah, she was. It was the shootout at the OK Corral where. She had this slight love affair with Mr. Chekhov.
Oh, yeah.
Who was by Walter Koenig, who's somebody I went to the neighborhood playhouse with.
Wow. What about John Coltrane? Your thoughts on John?
Well, just that, I worshiped the air he breathed and would check him out every chance I had, but I did not have deep personal involvement with Coltrane like I did Thelonious Monk.
Okay.
Thelonious Monk I got to be up close and personal with.
Got it. To me, Coltrane had the best tone of any saxophone player ever.
Thelonious Monk is kind of like
genius.
The painting of Paul Klee, Jean
right.
Miro.
Yeah.
Very childlike, but very sophisticated at the same time.
Joy, pure joy, right?
Pure genius and pure joy. Pure joy.
Yeah pure joy. Almost. Speaking of pure joy, what about Jerry Garcia? There's a lot of joy in that guy. A lot of other things, too,
Jerry,
but joy in the music.
Jerry also was not only a great musician artist, but he was a great artist. And
right,
if you ever get
right,
to,
yeah.
to explore some of Jerry's art, I think you'll be amazed.
Yeah, I've seen it.
He put the Grateful Dead movie the one called The Grateful Dead movie that begins with that wonderful cartoon with Cosmic Charlie.
Oh, yeah, I love it. Yeah, yeah.
That film is all pure Jerry, all the editing. He was in control there.
Right.
Jerry and I, the last time we talked, was discussing this wonderful organic, natural sculptor named Andy Goldsworthy. And if you don't know who I'm talking about, you might want to look him up, because he is truly amazing, and he only works with logs and boulders and twigs, and leaves, and just organic stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the last thing we did, I was sitting. I was remembering another time. The first Save a Show came about like this. We had our board meeting in Heartlands, Michigan. And this amazing woman, Nicole Grasset, who got the Legion of Honor for her work in smallpox and measles. She brought measles vaccine into Beirut through enemy aircraft fire. She was truly incredible and she was elegant too. She was wearing a Dior dress. Of course, it was a copy, and she could deal with me and then deal with the prime minister. Just whoosh, whoosh. And it was she who told us that 80% of the people in the world that are blind do not need to be blind and can get their sight back for about $10 when we first started doing SEVA. So the SEVA board fell out of Larry Brilliant's Rolodex. Larry, my best friend, a doctor who headed up the American team for smallpox eradication. Smallpox, the only disease in the history of the world to be totally eradicated. And Nicole came to Larry, who was teaching public health at the University of Michigan, and said, "Larry, we must do something about this blindness." So Larry,
what's causing the blindness? What's causing this?
Mostly cataract. Mostly lack
malnutrition, but young people, old people, everybody.
Yeah. Yeah, it's all over the place. But it's a simple 15-minute surgery. And if you're blind in the third world, they refer to you as a mouth without hands. It's devastating to the family, to the village. And we have helped perform over the years over 3.5 million sight-saving surgeries in starting out in Nepal and India and then to Cambodia, Tanzania, Tibet, all over the place. And so also on the board was Ram Dass and a lot of spiritual people, along with a lot of docs and health workers who worked on smallpox. Danny Rifkin, later the manager of the Grateful Dead.
Right.
And I was instructed to get the Grateful Dead to do our first benefit. I don't know if anybody out there has ever tried to get, like, you have a great cause and you say, "Oh, let's get the Rolling Stones." It is not easy. It's horribly, horribly hard unless there is a miracle, which is what happened when I got on my plane in Detroit to fly back to the Bay Area. Who should be on that plane but the Grateful Dead? And where are they going to go? They don't have parachutes. So I started on Mickey Hart, and he's a pushover. Billy Kreutzmann next. Then I went to Jerry, and Jerry was just such a sweet, kind man. He just said, "Well, we might as well." And everybody was lined up. And it was at the Kaiser Auditorium. It was produced by Bill Graham, who did not know it was a benefit. Why am I the last to find out these things? God
Oh, I love it.
I was sitting in Jerry's chair while the band is playing with Steve Parrish, who is Jerry's enormous roadie.
Right.
And we're token up. And who should pop back there but Bill Graham, who hands me a note. And I open it up, and it's a check for Seva for $10,000.
In what year is this, 1978?
Maybe. I'm not so good at that stuff. I said, Bill, why are you doing this? He said, because you did not hit on me, my friend. So that was our first big check.
That was a lot of money back then. It's probably worth almost $100,000. Today's dollars is what I'm trying to say. That's just incredible. I mean, so these people were just, they were the heart of gold band, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Right.
The biggest show
what about,
I ever did was The Dead and the Band in Toronto.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
For Seva.
Right. Beautiful.
That was the best.
And Ken Kesey you were friends with too, right?
Kesey and Krasner were the radio hosts on the Canadian show.
Wow.
I had it broadcast throughout the United States on NPR.
Mm-hmm. Great, great. What about, were you friends with Jackson Brown as well?
Jackson's done more shows for Seva than anybody else on earth.
Right.
And also anxious to get down to Central America and look at some of the projects. And Jackson's wonderful. And he does, you know, just do the thing. He goes into the very roots and the heart and soul of what he's involved in. I was so thrilled to go to jail with Jackson to protest the building of a nuclear reactor on an earthquake fault in Northern California. We were in jail.
I was at that protest. Yeah.
It is,
I don't know if you remember or not, but you were at the Dead's Greek Theater shows in '81. You were announcing that protest, and you brought cheerleaders with you from a high school.
Yeah. All these adventures are beautifully documented in this film, Saint Misbehavin'.
Yeah, it's a great movie.
All these stories, you're thinking, wavy gravy, you're just bullshitting. Well, you're going to see it. Before your very eyes, that it really happened. It all really happened, and it's still happening. And I am.
It's still, Wavy.
So
you need at least another 80 years on this planet. We need your help. So why don't we finish up with you want to talk about your breathing exercises and your mantra? Why don't we talk about that and kind of finish it up here?
Oh, with the children, I do this. One of my teachers is Ben Thich Nhat Hanh. He's a Vietnamese monk that Martin Luther King nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. He's just passed on a year or so ago. But I have the children all sit in the outdoor theater when I do my morning reading, and we begin. And you may try it: is breathing in, we calm our body, imagining cool lemonade sprinkling on all your molecules. Breathing out, we send a smile to the four corners of the universe. Breathing in this supreme moment, right here, right now. Breathing out, we know it's a wonderful moment. Then I have them scream yes three times. Yes, yes. Yes, and then we begin the day. That's it.
I love it. I love it. Do you give the kids a mantra?
We do it. That's what we do to start the day.
Got it. I love it. So the kids are getting really a good way to become good people, better kids, better adults.
God, and we're... You know, we've done camp so long, and we're getting the children of the children now.
Right.
And not only that, it's never too late to have a happy childhood. I've been doing adult camp for 15 years. We do 9 weeks for kids and 1 week for grown-ups. So
win a
rainbow, WINNARainbow.org. Check it out, SEVA.org. Check it out. It's spelled SEVA, but it's SEVA, pronounced. It's a Sanskrit word that means service to humankind.
So is my company's name. It's actually Sila, but people overtook it and became Sila, your own internal wisdom. Well, Wavy, it's been just great talking to you. I really enjoyed it. This hour and a half flew by. Just any last thoughts? I know the concert again is going to be in Sonoma on your birthday. What date is that again?
May 17th is the concert. Edward Sharp and the Magnetic Zeros. Steve Kimmock, the California Honey Drops, and Hot Buttered Rum, and surprise guests.
Will Greg Anton be playing drums?
I don't think so.
No, but, him and Steve been playing for a long time.
He may be playing with Kimmock. They've played together quite frequently. I don't know.
And Greg's
Steve
book
Kimmock
was a great book, Behind the Music. I read it recently. Greg was on the show. So
yes,
one never knows.
No, he's what a great man he is too. He's a lawyer also.
Oh yeah.
Does
Greg
insanely
insanely
good work.
Right.
One of my heroes. And part of that band was Martin Fierro. Ochoa.
Oh, Martin. I love Martin.
He is passed on. I have a picture of him on my altar. We used to sneak up behind each other and pull he used to pull my pants down or I'd pull his pants down.
I can see that. Martin was the great. For people listening, there's a band called Zero in the 90s, and just a beautiful band with some really fun people. Martin was probably the most fun.
Very extraordinary, Martin. He became an extension of the saxophone.
Oh, incredible saxophone player. Incredible set of lungs. He said he learned from Coltrane, too. He said Coltrane taught him some things on the sax when he was a kid. Well, Wavy, thank you. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it. If you ever want to do a guest host on the show, we love it. You can pick your own interview. You want to interview yourself or your wife or whoever you want. That's fine. You can have your man call my girl, blah, 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 blah.
Come to adult camp and we'll talk about it.
Yeah, I think I'm going to go there. I'm going to be in Marin County the last week in June before the Dead shows. So, yeah, definitely. Definitely.
All right.
Great. So this has been the Mindful Revolution with Wavy Gravy.
Evolve, revolve, and dissolve. God bless us.
It was a pleasure and an honor and a ride talking to you. Thank you so much.
Likewise.
It's been Wavy Gravy. Take care, Wavy. Namaste.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye, planes. Bye, bonds.